This is Arnie Arneson, and this is the Tuesday edition of The Attitude with Arnie Arneson and producer Ken Barnes. As many of you have come to expect, we begin our show every day with the voice of Colonel Vindman. He testified in the fall of 2019 before the impeachment hearing, and it was powerful testimony. And the thing that just sort of gnaws at me all the time is when he told his father it would be all right. And what we have learned is that nothing is all right. It was not all right for him. It was not all right for his brother. And clearly it's not all right for the rest of us. So the words of Colonel Vindman, make sure that they're in your ears when you vote in November of 2020.
Next month will mark 40 years since my family arrived in the United States as refugees. When my father was 47 years old, he left behind his entire life and the only home he had ever known to start over in the United States so his three sons could have a better and safer lives. His courageous decision inspired a deep sense of gratitude in my brothers and myself and instilled in us a sense of duty and service. All three of us have served or are currently serving in the military. My little brother sits behind me here today. Our collective military service is a special part of our family's story in America. I'm grateful for my father's brave act of hope 40 years ago and for the privilege of being an American citizen and public servant, where I can live free, free of fear for mine and my family's safety. Dad, I'm sitting here today in the U.S. Capitol talking to our elected professionals is proof that you made the right decision 40 years ago to leave the Soviet Union and come here to the United States of America in search of a better life for our family. Do not worry. I will be fine for telling the truth. Thank you again for your consideration. I'll be happy to answer your questions.
Okay, where do I go? What's my favorite place to sort of check out information, get new voices, hear from people who are real experts in their field? But I go to theconversation.com. And I mine that at least maybe two or three times a week because I just want to think beyond Donald Trump's tweets. I want to think beyond Tara Reid. I want to think beyond just sort of the emotional exhaustion of COVID-19, because I think we still have to figure out how we can address the future. So I'm looking at theconversation.com, and I see an interesting title. COVID-19 is a dress rehearsal for entrepreneurial approaches to climate change. Joining me right now is Jeffrey York. He is at the University of Colorado at Boulder. He teaches and researches on issues of environmental entrepreneurship and the simultaneous creation of ecological and economic goods. And he is interested in how and why entrepreneurs create new products, services, and industries that reduce environmental degradation. So let me welcome Professor York to the program. How are you, Jeffrey?
I'm doing really well, Arnie. Thank you so much for inviting me. It's a pleasure to be here.
So, you know, I'm looking at COVID-19, and what I know about COVID-19 is that everything is challenged simultaneously. And it's not just, you know, in New York, it's not just in the United States, it's a worldwide pandemic. And in a lot of ways, climate change is worldwide as well. Except that even if it is worldwide, it'll have different impacts depending on where you live. That's not only true around the world, it's even true in the United States. Sure. So if you're in Miami, you may have no more shoreline. If you're in California, you may be burning up, you know? I mean, so if you're in the Midwest, you may be underwater from floods. So even as we're looking at the fact that we'll all be experiencing climate change, it might be in a way that's different from other places. So tell me a little bit about how you look at the COVID-19 response. And then you look at the idea that this is an opportunity for entrepreneurs and maybe small business to respond in a more effective way than looking at something where you turn on a switch and there's a 50-state solution and a large solution that happens overnight.
Yeah, I think your point is very well taken. And exactly, the reality of what's going to need to be done in various communities is very different, just as it is with COVID-19, as it will be with climate change. Here in Colorado, we're going to have very different requirements of addressing climate change and mitigating the impacts of climate change than we will have in, say, California or on the East Coast or in South Carolina. It's going to be different. And entrepreneurs tend to have a little bit of a more on-the-ground view of understanding what are the specific impacts of what's happening in my community and understanding how to offer products and services that will address the needs of that community. So there's a lot of research on disasters and entrepreneurship in the wake of those disasters. And it turns out that while, yes, we need a centralized response, and I'm not trying to say that we don't, it can't be the only solution. We oftentimes need localized actors. We need folks to create solutions from their own creativity, their own network, their own means that address the needs of their community.
And well, so, what I'm hearing from you, just want to like mirror back. So in a lot of ways, what entrepreneurs understand is geography, in the sense that geography matters, because where you are, where you live, how you respond is not only because of the climate change or not only because of the pandemic, but that different communities respond differently. Different parts of the country respond differently. Maybe different histories give you and different social relationships. Maybe how they relate in Utah because of Mormons. And that's, I'm not being funny about that. I'm being serious. They have a different sort of familial relationship than people in other parts of the country. So what you are, I think, are suggesting is that if we invest and understand that small business and entrepreneurs might be more responsive to that, we might get better solutions.
Absolutely. And the last point you were making about history and culture and beliefs and the way individuals in a community view issues, I think is, I mean, we're absolutely seeing that in COVID-19. People on the left or the right view the issue of reopening businesses, for example, very differently. We all have the same data in hand, but we see the issue very differently. And climate change is the same. You know, and I think a lot of the time we've unfortunately been stuck in inaction because we're presented with conflicting views. On one side, you know, we're all going to die. Things are terrible. And no matter what you do, it's almost too late. And on the other side, oh, no, there's no problem at all. We don't even need to consider this. And I think deep down inside, we all know that the truth is probably a blend of those two stories.
Right.
And trying to find the path in between them is the way to action. Unfortunately, we've gotten stuck in that. And I like to believe, and I do believe based on my research, that entrepreneurship can offer us a path out of that.
So we're talking a lot about what may happen after 2020, assuming it may be a different president. And we're talking about a Green New Deal. So I kind of got a sense from your article at The Conversation that you want a Green New Deal to understand what you're writing about, so that it isn't just the assumption of large companies coming together with large solutions with a one size fits all, and that you want to almost have these sort of micro investments to allow the entrepreneurs to be able to make a more responsive result because they do know the geography, they do know the community. And if you make those as well as some of the big ones, you might get a better result. And in fact, maybe what those entrepreneurs are able to do, because they're able to sort of do it on a small scale, you might end up wanting to then replicate what they've done on a larger scale because they've been able to show the success strategy.
Right. And I think that's exactly right. And I think in situations where there's a great deal of uncertainty, such as climate change, you know, we know the climate is changing. We know that humans are the cause of it. And we know that there are going to be dire consequences if we don't address it. How exactly that's going to play out, though, is incredibly uncertain. And we can't really make accurate predictions, even with the best climate models, about how it's going to play out. In fact,
It
appears to be, if you follow the science, it looks like things are going to be much more dire much sooner than we've always thought. So if you take a step back from that and you say, okay, we're not sure what the solution is to all these things, and we're not even sure how to get past our current political ideology to all move together united,
yeah.
In my mind, and what my research indicates, is you need entrepreneurs to engage in a lot of different experiments to find solutions.
Absolutely. So let me just say something. I'm smiling, and let me tell you why. So back in the early 1990s, I ran for governor. Mm-hmm. And this is this is 1991, 92. And this is long before we were talking about universal healthcare, Medicare for all, single payer. But I kind of liked the idea of some kind of a universal healthcare system. But I also understood that, how could I encourage it, realizing I was running for governor in a state the size of a suburb, okay? Mm. And one of the things I put down was I created this white paper. And the white paper was basically something called Tri-State Care. And what I wanted to do was approach Maine and Vermont and say, look, together we're a little bit bigger than we are apart. Mm. That maybe we can go to the federal government and say, release us from Medicare, release us from Medicaid, let us be an experiment. It's not, it may not work, but it might work. And from this experiment, maybe you can learn what could work in other parts of the country. Maybe you could replicate what we did, but give us the opportunity to experiment with something that we know is a policy we need. We know that there's a problem with the healthcare system. And one of the reasons why I kind of thought about that, and that's sort of entrepreneurial from a government perspective, not necessarily from a small business perspective or an entrepreneur, but that I remember going to Canada and watching the Canadians, and the Canadians didn't do single payer overnight. They went province by province by province, and they experimented. They worked the kinks out. They figured out how it worked. And I think with climate change, I think you're also suggesting the same thing. It doesn't even have to be state by state. It can be even more smaller in a lot of ways, and maybe even more creative.
We looked at policies. We looked at people that went out and had knowledge, so consultants that intervened. And then we looked at whether or not the economics were really taking off for the industry. And it turns out those interventions made a difference in more conservative regions because there wasn't a lot of baseline adoption, but they didn't make a lot of difference in more liberal regions because there was already adoption of green building going on. Right, however, right. If you looked at the number of entrepreneurs in the green building sector in those counties over time, you saw a greater uptick in adoption of green building in both your conservative and both your liberal counties. And what this implies to us, and now we're looking at trying to test out and research now, is that regardless of the political ideology or the belief system in which a community is embedded, they can get behind entrepreneurs because they have that authenticity of being someone who's creating jobs, creating greater economic wealth, but also at the same time trying to boost environmentally friendly practices. And it allows folks from all different realms of ideology to get behind them. And so to us, my research team and myself, it really represents the idea that, hey, maybe this is a solution. Maybe looking at this is something we can all agree on a topic that the political parties and ideologies tend to disagree so much that really stymies our ability to address what is a critical problem.
So let me, again, I'm going to mirror back to you. So what I'm thinking is that I don't care whether you're a conservative or a liberal, you're going to look at the results. Right. And from a green standard, usually it means you're spending less on electricity, you're spending less on heat. Let's go to the great state of Texas. So my biggest radio station is KPFT in Houston. What do we know about Houston? Houston, big oil and gas community. What do we also know about Texas? Produces more wind energy than any state in the nation. Hallelujah. And it almost seems like we change people's opinions because their goal isn't to change an opinion. It's to show them a result.
Yes. And as an entrepreneur, you have very little choice but to focus on results because if you don't, you won't be an entrepreneur for very long, or maybe you'll be an entrepreneur in a different company because you don't have the luxury and the time of not focusing on results. And by the way, you're exactly right. We studied the emergence of the wind industry sector. Yeah. And if you look at it, it's when the conversation shifts away from it. You do need to get a wind energy sector started, according to our research. You do need some policies in place that mm-hmm. force some right. adoption. Right. But what really makes the difference after that, beyond the baseline, is whether or not the focus shifts away from the environmental impacts of wind and onto the economic impacts of wind as far as growing jobs, saving money, building greater resiliency. And when that happens, you'll see a statistically significant uptick beyond what you would get by just a mandatory policy.
So I have a dream. And I'm going to personalize this. We moved into this house in 2009 in Concord, New Hampshire. 2009, we had something called the Regional Greenhouse Gas Initiative that was adopted right about the same time. And one of the things it did was it allowed certain kind of financial benefits if you wanted to do some kind of like retrofitting of your house. So I was the second application in the minute the door opened. Why? To put 18 solar panels on my 1890 Queen Anne Victorian in Concord, New Hampshire. I believe I was probably the first house in the sort of downtown area, especially an old historic house, to do this. At first, everybody was appalled. Oh, you're going to destroy the look of your house. How could you do this? I want to walk you down the street now with me, because everybody has it. Okay. It's like, yeah. And I had to take a financial risk initially, because even with this grant, it was still more expensive because I was the first. It was before solar panels became, you know, less expensive, but I knew that I needed to role model because of my values and also my concern about climate change, that if I could role model it, one, it would allow other people to start dreaming it, that there were a lot of entrepreneurs that wanted to step in, but there's always kind of the sort of foolish risk taker, moi, who sort of starts. But then when you sort of look at, you get both policy support, but you also get the entrepreneurs who are then able to come in and sort of support you. And it really is amazing to me, because now, even though it's New England and people are saying, how much solar can you actually get? It's now almost an acceptable thing to do, because it's a win-win. You address green energy and you address climate change if that's really your cause celeb. But more importantly, you can smile because you see your energy bill decline and in fairly short order. As soon as we can figure out batteries at an affordable rate, I suspect there'll be another huge change. But I think it took a combination of kind of those initial risk takers, a little bit of support from government, and then everybody realizing, because entrepreneurs stepped in, that there was an affordable way to do it that was a win-win.
Yeah, that's absolutely correct. And I did a similar thing here in 2010 in Colorado. If I'd, I think it would cost me a quarter of what it cost me to buy my solar panels today. Yeah. But I'm still happy I did it, because it starts to make it be viewed by your neighbors and by others as, this is possible. Somebody else has done it. And it's an interesting thing. If you look at the motivations and what drives those same green building entrepreneurs to enter in and start doing their business in the first place, we looked at existing firms and their entry into the green building sector. And then we looked at startups and their entry into the green building sector. And it turns out that the startups are heavily influenced by social norms, the belief in a community that it's important to address the environment. And they're also heavily influenced by social movement organizations, activism happening around climate change.
Of course.
Perhaps unsurprisingly, existing larger firms are not impacted by either of those things. They're impacted when it's clear there's an economic opportunity because a subsidy is put in place.
Right.
There's a policy put in place to require green building.
Right.
But you got to have those entrepreneurs that move first and take on more risk in order to validate that it's even possible. And that's the role that entrepreneurship performs. That you don't get quite the same thing when you just force large companies to start doing things that are less bad.
Okay, so how do these entrepreneurs get the kind of support they need without the control? And what I mean is that, you know, usually a lot of dollars are earmarked, or there's an expectation of showing a result in this amount of time. And yet what entrepreneurs are doing is they're taking risks, and you want them to take risks. And frankly, I'm not even offended if they fail, because we tried and we saw what didn't work. And how do we get government? How do we get financiers? I can't ask these guys to take it all on their own backs. They can't. There's got to be an opportunity for us to make the investment and encourage this investment, recognizing that failure is not failure. And it's funny, when I was teaching at Harvard, I used a quote from Bella Abzug, and I'm very political. But Bella Abzug's quote is really a quote I almost want to give to every government official and every banker. Mm-hmm. And this was her quote: you have to lose, lose, lose to win. And in a lot of ways, from an entrepreneurial perspective, you have to fail, fail, fail to succeed. And we don't have a system in place that quite comprehends that, because everybody's looking for the payback without realizing, in some ways, even the failure is kind of a payback.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and that's what the data shows. You can certainly predict someone's entrepreneurial success by previous failure, which is sort of counterintuitive.
But, exactly.
That's, in my teaching, I really try to create an environment where the students will struggle and they will compete and they will fail, not the class, but the venture they're trying to start will be failed. And I think that's a really valuable learning. You learn a lot from that.
Exactly.
As to how you support them, I think You know, interestingly enough, that's actually a research project we have going on right now. We're trying
to... I'll call you later.
Well, we have results. I will say they're not peer-reviewed or published yet. You know, this could change. But as of now, it turns out this is really fascinating to me because I live in Boulder, Colorado, where everybody's very eco-conscious and very alert to these things. And you would think, well, you know, that's where I should go start my environmentally relevant business. Everybody's going to support me and everybody's going to love me. And, you know, they'll buy me beers at the brew pub and I'll be the head of the town. And that's true. But it turns out you really want to be in communities where there's a high environmental awareness, but there's also a high belief in market mechanisms and in entrepreneurship and in business. So those communities where the environmentalism is high, but there's not a huge belief in the power of business or that business is a good thing is actually not a good place for you to be starting.
So give me an example of that win-win strategy. So who's environmental and yet sort of business oriented?
Actually Boulder is one of those places. If you look at it, it tends to be college towns. It tends to be places. Ithaca is another one.
Of course.
There's a bunch of different ones. Portland, or San Francisco. But you're looking at these communities where there is not some kind of duality, but rather a complexity to people's beliefs that they're pro-business and also pro-environment. That just means you're more likely to succeed. And interestingly, in those same places, you're also likely to have mechanisms that are going to help you succeed. Programs like you were just talking about, where citizens are rewarded for their adoption of environmental practices. And that, of course, creates economic opportunity for entrepreneurs. Absolutely. So the same thing in Colorado with solar and with wind and other technologies that come on. So I think it's those localized incentives. And incentives are, at least in our research, much more effective than requirements that allow those entrepreneurs to see and to make their financials make more sense more quickly and survive.
All right, last question. You mentioned family in your article. The idea of family being important. Please explain that piece because I'm sitting here going, well, how big a family and what kind of family and what are you talking about? So sort of quickly explain to me what the heck, what does you mean by that as creating a positive result?
Yeah, so we looked at the entry of solar energy entrepreneurs and what were the social norms that drove them. So social norms are held at a community level. They're what we believe other people believe is the right thing to do.
Right.
And it's unsurprising. Higher environmental social norms did increase the number of entrants, people that started solar energy business. And we thought perhaps nonconformity, you know, there's a lot of nonconformity in entrepreneurship. Turned out that didn't matter at all. What did matter that totally surprised us was the level of family interdependence. So the degree to which a community and individuals in a community believe that it's important to spend time with my family and that I need to be in touch with them and close to them. That had a statistically significant impact on the number of solar energy entrants coupled with supportive policies. So the way we interpret that is that when people care deeply about spending time with their families, they feel a greater commitment to the future because they see future generations. And they start to think about, well, what can I do to help create a better future? And then when you also have those economic incentives in place, solar energy starts to look like a pretty good opportunity to do something meaningful. I can't tell you how many energy entrepreneurs I've talked to.
Unbelievable. I mean, I shouldn't be surprised because what you're saying to me is, and I used to give graduation speeches, and I would talk about the loss of generational ethics.
Right.
The idea that you really do care about the future. And the idea that you do care about your family. And it's not just your family. You actually see this sort of a bigger family. But there is this idea that there's a commitment not to the now, but to the tomorrow. And what I'm hearing from you is you're describing family in a way that I would describe not just as in a familial situation, but in a way that understands that, that it's really interesting. In the Jewish faith, they describe heaven this way. That you have an obligation to make your heaven here. And the idea of making your heaven here really is a way of reinforcing that you will be a good steward of the environment, that you will look at the future for your family because it is important. Because if this is where heaven is, then you have an obligation to make sure that it's healthy, it's robust, it's safe, it's secure. If you somehow think heaven is on the other side after you die, then but that concept, I think, is also interesting because it also too relates to family in a kind of a curious way.
Yeah. And I mean, I've interviewed dozens of environmental entrepreneurs, and the story that I get told probably 90% of the time is the people that succeed are people who had a previous career in business, had their first child, or experienced a loss in their family, and just started a pattern of deep reflection and said, what can I do different? And they often find their way into renewable energy and green buildings, a place where they can use their knowledge of business, their experience as business people and as entrepreneurs, to do something that they feel like they're really doing something good.
Wow, I love it. All right, so if you go to theconversation.com, you'll find Jeffrey York, and you'll find Jeffrey York's article, COVID-19 is a dress rehearsal for entrepreneurial approaches to climate change. I hope so. I hope so. I think in some ways the pandemic is horrific, but it's also kind of a gift. It shows how connected we are. It shows how vulnerable we are. And also shows that if we work together, maybe we can find solutions. And it's not a right-left solution. It's just a solution. Thank you so much for joining us, Jeffrey. I really appreciate it.
Well, thank you for having me. It was a pleasure talking with you.
You're welcome. All right, everyone, stick around for Parle Deux. We're talking in fraud and mail-in voting. Actually, that's not true. All right, we'll be right back.
I'm Dr. Anthony Lazowitz, and this is Climate Connections. Through her faith, Maryland resident Doris Marlin has found her way to a life of climate activism. Marlin is a Unitarian Universalist. She says Unitarian principles affirm the worth of every person and the need for global justice and equality.
We see the moral implications and the injustice that is happening as a result of climate change. It's very obvious in the global South that those who have done the least to contribute are the most vulnerable and will suffer the most and the soonest from climate change. So at a very deep level, faith and climate connect as a moral issue.
Marlin says tackling these injustices requires reducing carbon pollution in communities everywhere. So she is a lay leader with a nationwide Unitarian initiative called Strengthen Local Climate Commitments. It helps people advocate for clean, renewable energy in their communities and hold their local representatives accountable for meeting climate goals.
It brings together people at the local level to work with their colleagues, with their neighbors, on climate solutions.
With the goal of creating a more just world. Climate Connections is produced by the Yale Center for Environmental Communication. Learn more at yaleclimateconnections.org.
You'd think that making voting faster and easier to do would be a no-brainer and nonpartisan too. But some states are trying new ID laws that are seriously flawed. Trotting out that same old tired myth, but voter fraud is a fraud. These types of laws discriminate, there's evidence to confirm it. And why can't you use a student ID, but you can use a gun permit? They're trying voter intimidation tactics that have been outlawed. Voter suppression is a real problem, but voter fraud is a fraud. The GOP began this myth with laws they tried to pass. Now baseless fears of election rigging may bite them in the ass. There's even been attempts at illegal poll watching with its thinly veiled racist nod over something that's nearly non-existent. 'Cause voter fraud is a fraud. For example, you're more likely to win the lottery or be struck by lightning or be elected as president, which in many cases is frightening, or give birth to quadruplets or win an Olympic gold medal or be hurt by a pogo stick or an exploding Rachel Ray tea kettle. Being attacked by a shark is more likely, also flying to the moon. Being canonized or being killed by a vending machine or balloon or by flammable pajamas or mad cow disease. Voter fraud is less likely than all of these. Such ludicrous excuses this argument is made of. which makes you think, which part of democracy are they afraid of? Disenfranchising hundreds of thousands of voters, trampling on rights so roughshod. When restrictions are so broad, we can see through the facade of this right-wing goon squad as they desperately maraud till we're frankly slack-jawed. Okay, I'm out of rhymes. 'Cause voter fraud is a fraud. Yeah, 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 yeah.
Welcome back to part two of the Tuesday edition of The Attitude with Arnie Arneson and producer Ken Barnes. So ProPublica, another great place, great investigative reporting. We need more and more of these institutions as we see a real challenge to journalism and frankly, the kind of media that we need that really looks at the facts and takes the time to sort of do the work. And I'm looking at ProPublica, and sure enough, I'm crazy about mail-in voting right now, especially because of the pandemic. And I see this headline and I'm going, oh my God, I have agita. A conservative legal group significantly miscalculated data in a report on mail-in voting. Joining us right now is ProPublica reporter Derek Willis. He is a news applications developer at ProPublica, focusing on, of course, politics and elections. And he previously was a reporter at the New York Times, the Washington Post, and my other favorite place, the Center for Public Integrity. I have to tell you this, Derek, I practically raised Dave Leventhal, or at least I claim to have raised him, because I've known him since he was a kid.
He's a great guy.
He is a wonderful, wonderful young man. I'm so proud of him. So let's talk a little bit about what we know. We know that because of the pandemic, there is a real need to ensure the kind of security and safety for people when they exercise the franchise. In-person voting puts everybody at risk. And it puts everybody at risk, not only those that want to sort of check the box and vote, but those that have to oversee the voting to make sure that it is safe and secure. And then I was thinking about it this morning. So I live in Concord, New Hampshire. It's a little tiny sort of city. And I'm thinking, I've never really had to wait online because I live in a sort of more, you know, small, kind of suburban type of place. But if you live in a city like, you know, Madison or Milwaukee, for example, you're living in an urban area where by definition, lines are us. So finding an alternative to in-person voting is very important if you want to encourage people to do something in a way where they don't have to make a choice between their health and life and whether they vote. So talk to me a little bit about this group that miscalculated the data. First of all, I want to know a little bit about the group that was looking and why miscalculating the data might be something that would be in their benefit.
So the group is the Public Interest Legal Foundation, and they are a conservative group headed by a lawyer named J. Christian Adams, who used to work in the Justice Department from 2005 to about 2010. He is also was also a member of the, you might recall, the now disbanded Trump Administration Commission on Election Integrity that was formed pretty much right after the 2016 election to sort of look into, you know, supposed alleged irregularities in the vote. There were a lot of issues with that commission, but Christian Adams was a member of that. He's the president of this Public Interest Legal Foundation. And what they do, among other things, is they often spend their time bringing suits or other sort of legal challenges to try to force local and state elections officials to enforce the law in the way that the foundation thinks that they're not currently doing. And what that usually means as a practical effect is normally that's talking about removing people from the voting rolls who meet some threshold or definition of inactivity. So there's a couple ways they define that. One of those involves whether or not they think that those folks might be registered in another state. And because of the decentralized nature of elections in the United States, this is invariably a really messy sort of area. Like the reason that people sort of often, or can, I should say, show up on two different states' election rolls is if they move and you don't get, you know, one doesn't remove you from the rolls where you used to live and you now are on the rolls in the place that you do live.
So let me stop you there, Derek. Let me just stop you there.
Yeah.
So and that's very common. I mean, more common, I think, than some people know. But
actually happened to me.
Yeah, exactly. So here's my question. When I move from Cucamonga, Wisconsin, to Concord, New Hampshire, do I have an obligation to call Cucamonga and say, oh, by the way, remove me from the election rolls, remove me from the PTA, remove me from the Library Society, because I no longer live in Cucamonga. I now live in Concord. I mean, I am looking at this and I'm rolling my eyes that somehow, because you are listed in two places, that you are intending to defraud, and that your intent is to sort of choose where you want to vote rather than what is the normal course of events, which is you moved, and there is no legal obligation to inform every single organization, including the people, the place where you vote, that I don't live here anymore. Am I correct?
Yeah, you're correct. I mean, there isn't a legal obligation. I think states have done a better job now of sort of most states, not all, but most states are now part of this consortium that share information about their voter list so that people can look and be like, oh, okay, so this person does seem to match this person. And that way we can, at least with some certainty, rather than just sort of guesswork, start to maybe remove those kinds of circumstances in which you'd have somebody who'd be on the rolls in two different places. But the thing, the point that I think the foundation is trying to make in its legal work is not so much, I don't want to speak for them, but not so much that you personally would then commit voter fraud, although, I suppose that's a theoretical possibility, but that other people could take advantage of the fact that this registration and in a mail-in ballot scenario, a ballot exists somewhere and could be sort of used by other folks.
Let me just say something. So what you were suggesting is that if we had universal mail-in voting for the 2020 election, okay? And I am registered in Cucamonga still, and I'm also registered in Concord, New Hampshire, that when they send out the universal mail-in voting, I could receive it even though I'm not living there anymore, that, Arnie Arneson, that no longer exists in Cucamonga, would get a mail-in voting ballot sent to a place where I'm no longer living, and I'll also be getting my mail-in ballot to Concord, New Hampshire, which is where I'm living. And therefore, because they're sending it to my old address, to the person that no longer lives there, that there is the potential for fraud.
Yes. I think And again, I want to stress that, like, the folks that we talk to who study elections and who run elections, this is like that scenario is not like it's not the top of their list of worries in the sense that it would require a large amount of organization effort and frankly a pretty sophisticated conspiracy in order to do this in a way that would actually affect the outcome of most elections. I think the most vulnerable ones, and I think everyone agrees with this, the most vulnerable elections to any sort of fraud are local elections because they involve usually the smallest electorate, right? So like, it's the highest degree of, the highest chance of success, I suppose, with the least amount of effort, right? But it still would take some effort.
Right.
And the thing about this is that the folks like we talked to, like they acknowledge that in theory this possibility exists, but also like the Public Interest Legal Foundation, the point of this report that we looked at that they issued was that there were, over the last four elections, there were 28 million ballots that were sent out by mail to voters that were not returned to offices to be counted. And they
care. That's good. If you're not returning it, you're not fraud. So, I mean, you would think that that return would be their issue, but if it ended up that you sent it and it never got returned, sounds to me it went into like the circular file.
Right. And so, like, one of the folks we spoke to, Paul Gronke, who's a professor out in Portland at Reed College, basically said, "Yeah, I think I know where most of these ballots ended up. They ended up in the landfill. To be fair, he lives in Oregon, so hopefully recycling, right?
Exactly.
But there's this idea of that if the suggestion I think that the group is trying to make here is that if you're sending out ballots and they're not being returned, then something like a couple of possibilities. One, right. Something could be, you know, like there's a risk there that those ballots could be collected or turned in or filled out by people. But there's also other possibilities. And one of those is that people don't vote. Like not everyone votes, right? And so like of those 28 million, of that 28 million, about 12 million of those ballots are from Colorado, Washington, and Oregon.
Right.
Those three states are vote by mail states, right, where by law, every registered voter gets a mail ballot. Now, even though there are studies out there that show that states that do vote by mail have higher rates of turnout than most other states, there's still between around 30% of the electorate who doesn't, in those states, that who don't cast a ballot.
They don't give a crap. I gotcha.
And so
we're not making you vote. We're saying we're handing it to you and saying, if you want to exercise the franchise, here it is. And a lot of people are going, I don't care about this. And they throw it away.
And the issue with this 28 million numbers essentially is that like the foundation is saying the integrity of the vote's at risk because these ballots are not accounted for. And again, the folks that we talk to say they're not accounted for because the people who got the ballots didn't cast them, you know, and so they are.
Oh my God.
In theory, like they are as at risk for fraud, I suppose, as people who do not, you know, who vote in person but choose not to for any particular election. That someone could go up and try to pose as them.
Right.
In some way. Now, mail, I will say, it is an accurate and fair statement to say that, like, of the types of voter fraud that could possibly exist, absentee ballot or mail ballot is probably the easiest to commit because it doesn't require someone to go and vote in person.
Right.
It doesn't make it simple, but it is easier than sort of impersonating someone or having their ID or knowing their home address and all this sort of thing. And but I think like the issue here is that if we're going to have like a sophisticated and constructive conversation about ballot security and about like holding elections in a really unconventional time and like with in challenging circumstance,
then
it's probably better for us, all of us, if we have that conversation based on what the actual threats are and what the actual circumstances are.
So let me just say something. As I'm listening to you, I'm out of my mind. And so you point out, first of all, that they gave incorrect figures and they gave inflated figures. So I want people to understand what the inflation was based on. I also want people to understand why we're having this conversation is that Donald Trump quoted this report. So, I mean, there's always a reason for this. And that is, I mean, we could talk about this organization, but they needed to move up the food chain and they needed to come out of Donald Trump's tweet feed or out of his mouth in order for it to even gain even more credibility, since what you find out is the idea of voting by mail is something that has a partisan angle to it. You know, those that want to encourage people to feel safe and secure in voting and might encourage more people to participate are people that don't like voters. I mean, people that like voters. You know what I mean? So I think, you know, in a funny way, I want people to understand this report, but also understand who actually mirrored this report was the President of the United States. Not only was it based on inaccurate information, but even as you play it out, your point is that if there is any potential for fraud, it is pretty small anyway. It would take a lot of effort to have it happen. And I just want to remind everyone, this is the same President of the United States says, what's 50,000 people that could die from the pandemic? Oh, what's 75,000 people that could die from the pandemic? Oh, it could be 100,000. This is a guy who's willing to be loosey-goosey with life and death. And yet when it comes to vote by mail, you know, he's going to say, aha, look at this. There's the potential for fraud. And his standard is so interesting because it's so different from what we're seeing with the pandemic. And yet, as you point out, all the information that we've seen, yes, this might be the weakest way of voting because it isn't in person, still the likelihood of fraud is still pretty de minimis.
Yeah. So let me address the sort of the number that they got wrong, which is there are the post office has a system that in place, they work with election officials at the local and state level. and they put in place ballot tracking systems. So the same way that if you order a package from a company and you can track its delivery,
Oh yeah.
Local election officials can also, in most jurisdictions that offer vote by mail, most of those jurisdictions can also track where that ballot goes. And so they know, for example, if that ballot was delivered to a address, to the address it was intended to. Mm-hmm. Some of those ballots get returned as undelivered, mm-hmm. undeliverable. And mm-hmm. so that happens for lots of reasons. People move and leave no forwarding address. They register and put in like a bad address or an address mm-hmm. that doesn't, you know, like no longer exists.
Right.
So in 2016, there were about 500,000, like 560,000 mail-in ballots across the United States that were sent out and then returned as undeliverable. And so when this report came out, it cited as the 2018 equivalent for that, a number that was much higher, that was over 1 million ballots that had been sent out and returned as undeliverable, which really struck me. It was the first thing I noticed about the report, because like that's almost a 90% increase over 2016. I thought that would be pretty alarming and should be pretty alarming if it were true, in the sense that like we should not be getting worse at figuring out where people live and being able to deliver mail to them.
But let's also remember 2016 was a presidential election. This was a midterm election. Right. 2016, it was, I mean, just the raw numbers of people that vote. For 2018 to be worse, it would be really worse.
Right. That would be a significant problem. And then sort of, I went and grabbed the data that they use, which is public data that's reported by the Election Assistance Commission, a federal agency, and calculated, and they had doubled the number. Actual number in 2018.
Well,
I'm pretty, in talking with the folks in the group, I'm pretty sure that they didn't intend to double the number. I think like when I pointed out to them, they're like, oh, they confirmed it. And we're like, oh yeah, you're right. We doubled the number. And they corrected it, which is the right thing to do. Yeah. But I think like the math error they made. I think, and obviously the article was about that to a certain extent, but most of the piece, I think we went into sort of this larger discussion of what that 28 million number, which reflects ballots that were sent out and not returned, either for counting or as undeliverable, what that really means. Yeah. Because it's a big number, and big numbers can be really sort of like get your attention, but also be a little frightening or a little intimidating, right. or can, you know, and get the sense of, oh, wow, that seems bad because it's a big number. And so I think like the what we're trying to get at here essentially is like, if we have a discussion about this, what does that actually mean? What is that 28 million, and how do people who work in elections understand it?
All right, Ken, you want to weigh in?
Well, I just wanted to add one other thing, Derek, to your reasoning about why this report is not very helpful for making policy about election fraud. But it take a step back and look at the history. This kind of election fraud is not the motivation behind conservatives suppressing the vote. In fact, 10 or 15 years before we were ever mailing out ballots in these large percentages, 100% in Oregon or wherever it is, Governor Kemp in Georgia and others long before him were trying to suppress the vote everywhere and keep people from coming, especially in communities of color. And, you know, they claimed fraud. Trump claimed fraud in his own presidential election before he found out that he won it. This is a false reason. It's a straw man reason. Even if they got the numbers right, this isn't really why they're motivated to say, let's not mail ballots and encourage folks to vote.
But Derek, you and I both know that right now, fraud may be their theme song, but if they could crunch numbers and come up with 28 million or give a big number, then that big number seems to reinforce that fraud argument is more real than Memrex. And sure. I think that's really what the rationale is here. So I have a couple of questions for you, because I've never done mail-in voting. Is there a way to up the integrity of mail-in voting? in the sense that that you would be required to put in a special number, or that you would be required to give some specific information, so that if people are concerned about that the person who actually received the ballot is the person that was intended, the person that filled out the ballot was the person intended and mailed it back. So what happens in places like Colorado? What happens in places like California to make sure that the match is as real as possible and that people can trust the result?
It's a good question. There are a bunch of things that states and counties do to try to verify that a mail-in ballot is, you know, coming from the person who
exactly.
One of those is signature matching, which is okay, right? I mean, like, and even if you vote in person, sometimes you have to sign into the book, and like the signature matching is used. So like, that's something that I think people know. What is interesting about that, or maybe, you know, interesting, but like occasionally problematic about that, is that a lot of folks, I mean, like, you know, I don't know that I would have noticed this except thinking about it in this context, but when I was younger, I signed my name differently than I do now, right? Through you know, aging, laziness, whatever, you know, like, so, and like that can be the age of the signature, the age of the signatory can be an issue.
Right.
So like, there's that. One of the other ways is some states require certain other steps to do. So for example, having a witness sign it as well, who is not you, right? So like, essentially that, it's not a foolproof thing, but it is something where it's, where you think about like, you have to take an additional step. So if you were going to commit fraud, you would have to like find other people to do this with. And then the other thing that I think most people actually agree upon is this practice, what's known as ballot harvesting, where a person can go and collect multiple mail-in ballots and then deliver them on behalf of voters. There are a bunch of states that allow this, but a bunch of them have different rules for this. And I think like that's actually worthy of a lot of attention and discussion, because that's what happened in North Carolina with that congressional.
Right, I remember that.
So like there are, but I think the takeaway from this is that there are multiple ways to get at this and multiple ways to reinforce the integrity of the election. And those are all going to require us to have like not only good conversations, but good conversations based.
Okay, so I'm going to end the conversation pretty quickly, but I just did something today. I applied for unemployment. I mean, I'm on a radio station that doesn't get paid anyway, but my real job is no longer producing anything in the way of revenue. So I applied for unemployment. They asked me 5 questions. The questions were in case I couldn't remember something, you know, my father's middle name,
my daughter's,
where was my daughter born? My mother's maiden name, you know, I mean, like, what was my first elementary school? I mean, 5, not one, but freaking 5. And I'm thinking, what about that? What about the idea that you have 2 or 3 questions that go with your name? Not your geography. I mean, you could move within a state, you could age, but it might be so that therefore, again, we're trying to create that sense of the integrity of the result. You know, it's better than a witness because you don't need a human being in there when you check the box. But at the same time, they're doing this for unemployment. I mean, my Gmail account does it too. You know, they all do this. Why aren't we connecting that kind of thing where some kind of personal information that only you would know, you know? The year of your first divorce. I mean, whatever. I mean, what, it sounds crazy. But I just think that in a lot of ways, we don't have to, it doesn't have to be rocket science, but if we can do just a little bit more, then everybody would smile like Arnie's smiling. And at the same time, it would say, yeah, that probably might be not a bad thing.
Yeah, it's a good question. I don't have a perfect answer for it, but I think like, you know, when it comes to like sort of the rules around voting, they tend to, like, the more rules that we put in place, they tend to affect the people at the margins of society, right?
Exactly. So
when you put in a voter ID law, it's usually the people who are like most affected are folks who are mostly elderly, who have given up driving. Maybe they're moved into assisted living.
Exactly.
Right. And so like, or it's folks at the other end of the spectrum who they haven't had their license yet, but they're eligible to vote. And like, so like, you know, it's an interesting question and a good and worthy of discussion. I think like every action on that end probably has some sort of unintended consequence we have to think about as well.
All right, Derek Willis, thank you so much for writing for ProPublica. The title of the piece, "A Conservative Legal Group Significantly Miscalculated Data in a Report on Mail-in Voting." And of course, that report was quoted by Donald Trump. I just want to make sure that we connect all the dots so that we understand that not only do we want to ensure the integrity of the vote, but we also want to make sure the integrity of the investigation into the vote. So if they're suggesting mail fraud and mail-in voting fraud, then it turns out that that information was not exactly close to accurate, and that some of the suggestions they were making probably had nothing to do with fraud. Derek Willis, thank you so much for joining us, and thank you for writing for ProPublica.
Thanks for having me. I'm glad to be here.
It's a pleasure. This is the Tuesday edition of The Attitude with Arnie Arneson and producer Ken Barnes. We'll chat tomorrow. Ciao.
Same as the old boss.